When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Oh, hello, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints.
What's Deadly Class?
See, you're the problem. You're why we can't have nice things. Deadly Class was a sci-fi show starring Benedict Wong, where he is basically the headmaster of, like, crime lord assassin in Hogwarts. And that sounds
so it's crappy. X-Men?
Yeah,
because it's a sci-fi show, and I see sci-fi and go, that's cool. I'll wait till someone tells me it's actually worth watching.
Yeah, it was. It's very like just 80s. It's got a cool 80s vibe. It's very anti-Reagan, but yeah, it's just a cool show about assassin school, and also like it's produced by the Russo brothers. And so, like, the action sequences are genuinely incredible. It, like, builds toward this, season finale that they set up this, like, massive, like, assault on a mansion in San Francisco. And it's just, like, 45 minutes of watching them, like, storm this building. And it's amazing.
Wow.
So, anyway.
Shout
but it was canceled.
To Deadly Class. Sorry.
I think I've got it now.
Oh, this isn't just the podcast now? Okay, sure. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
It can be the podcast. I don't know. Look, I've been gone for a week. Maybe things are different now.
I mean...
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately.
Oh, I've been provoked.
And
gather
inspired.
Around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick
Klepek. It's not Deadly Class, because it was canceled. Wait, is that Bickin' and Cut? I don't know where we're at
it's
in the timeline anymore.
It's all in, I think.
Kato, I knew that. I knew that, Kato. Rob is he's claiming he's drinking water, but that's just a tall glass of vodka as he tries to get through this.
We've also got Danielle Riendo.
Oh, hello. I'm inspired.
Every time I say that now, I'm like, don't say Riendo. Don't like, Frankify it.
It's fine either way.
And, of course, you also just heard in there, we got Kato working the boards. So, Patrick, I was...
He just laughs.
As Kato, I don't know, picked up. I just want to point out that in response to that, Kato just burst into a fit of giggling at being just introduced. I don't know if it'll make it on a mic. Just wanted to make sure it was noted in the record.
It's beautiful.
So, I just got back from vacation.
Excuse me, sorry.
What
you're on vacation.
Is wrong?
You did like a big, like...
And then
I happened to glance up at the.
All right. So I just got back from vacation. And Patrick, while I was sort of marooned on an island in Lake Michigan, I saw you tweeting about the 2014 Gareth Edwards Godzilla, which is a movie that I have a real soft spot for. But you want to dig into, like, why were you rewatching it? And it looked like you had a different reaction to it watching it now than you remembered from the previous time you saw it.
Yeah, so there's a new Godzilla film out in the Monsterverse, comprised of the 2014 Godzilla, the 2016 or 2017 Kong Skull Island.
Oh, right.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and then will probably be a finale based on the box office of the new one, Godzilla vs. Kong. And the 2014 one I was revisiting because when I saw it in the theater, I had such a opposite reaction than most of the people walking out of that. It's a movie in which Godzilla is, I believed, because people were so annoyed, noted the amount of time that Godzilla is in the film, which is like 11 minutes of, you know, like a 2-hour and 10-minute movie. And I came out of that movie thinking like it was like the most effective 11 minutes I've like seen to display a monster in a film of that scale, for a creature that I'm intimately aware of, have seen for decades, and it seemed impossible for me to actually show any awe, which is usually the case upon sequels, reboots, reimaginings, if you're old enough to have been a part of it for decades or for years. And reviewing it specifically through that lens of, like, okay, whatever, throw away all the human characters, it's fine, we can talk about that part, but, like, I was viewing it specifically, like, to try and have a greater appreciation of, like, what the camera was doing to display the creatures in the original Godzilla in 2014, which is, there's Godzilla, and there are the two sort of spin-off original creations, which they call Mutos, which are basically big bugs. And I came away just, like, floored all over again, both for how it stands up in an era where special effects are advancing every year, and yet a movie from 2014, I think, feels just as impressive, if not more so, now in the way it understood how to convey a very specific version of Godzilla, which harkens back to the original Gojira, the original Japanese film. I think Godzilla in popular culture now is thought of as kind of, it's a man in a suit, it's a joke, it's basically like, you're watching a bunch of humans do inane things so you can get to the what ultimately is actually like 10 minutes of fighting in those movies if you actually go back and watch them. Mm-hmm. Very, very goofy, very wrestling. And that betrays, by virtue of becoming a franchise, they had to leave that stuff behind. Horror movies do this all the time. When it stops being scary, you lean into humor and absurdity. And the original Gojira is a really... even now, holds up. There's a Criterion version of it that is well worth getting. It's a terrific collection of that film. Watching it now, it is still like a deep, terrifying meditation on like Godzilla being this reaction to Hiroshima and World War II. And this movie takes a different tact of the 2014 of if a thing, you know, it, instead of it being a result of nuclear testing, the nuclear testing, it is revealed, was actually to try and kill it. And this is just an ancient race of enormous sky-filling creatures that once ruled the Earth. And that movie treats that seriously to the degree of wanting to... What would that scale be like to see something that monstrous, that enormous? And I think it was really successful. And so, in conclusion, my takeaway was just such a great appreciation of what that movie accomplished, because I think it's misunderstood... people wanted something else for that movie. They wanted monsters fighting. And the moments when that movie delivers it, I think, are spectacular and are more spectacular because it is so restrained. And I love it. I think it's genuinely a masterpiece in that genre of film.
Danielle, I'm curious where you're at with this movie and, sure. and where you're at with, like, Gareth Edwards more generally.
Well, that's actually a good question, and I'll need to open another tab to look at
so
more
he directed, of his work. Most recently, Rogue One. Which also like really has like liked. A
okay
yeah you to like a you know reductive
but also
like,
famously taken off that and sort of
because
the,
I guess like Lucas felt it was too dark
right and so Tony Gilroy ended right. up there's a debate about how much of Rogue One is Edwards. Like, to me it still feels like you can feel his like hand on it, but also it does feel like a Tony Gilroy movie. So
I think what remains in Rogue One is that sense of the camera.
Yeah.
Even in the final battle of Rogue One, which is completely shot by Gilroy, I believe, and not by Edwards, it still feels like grounded and human and tries to, like, there are shots of like, you know, the giant empire, you know, walkers and stuff like that, where it's like, that's what Edwards is often going for, mm-hmm. is trying to convey scale. And before that, he got the Godzilla gig, which was his first major movie, after a movie called Monsters. Which is right. really, really good. It's a, it's about a world in which I forget the mythology, but I believe it's like alien creatures. No,
it's actually really fascinating. So it's a Danielle. Did you ever see this one? Because it seems like a you movie.
No, and now I'm upset that okay. I haven't.
Oh, you should. It has one of those beautiful endings you will ever see in like a really just profound, like aha kind of ending. You would love it, I think.
Yeah, this looks like my shit, 100%. Look at this.
But I forget the general
super
setup.
Indie. Okay. And so it ends up being kind of a movie about anxieties about Latin America and the U.S. border, told more from a like Latin American and Central America's perspective of like trying to make the journey out of.
The Mexican border has actually been like walled off, right?
Yeah,
like the monsters that I've. Again, I forget like the instigating incident, but these like sort of towering creatures that aren't quite kaiju or like Godzilla size, but are like a skyscraper sized creature. They just sort of like have been contained to different zones across the status quo is now just they exist and we just don't go to these areas anymore, and the monsters own them.
But the funny thing is, it's basically a road trip movie. About this pair of characters, like a reporter and like a rich heiress. It's like a bit like It Happened One Night, but with kaiju, I suppose. But yeah, basically it's all like low budget. There basically is no budget. The CG.
He did the special effects
crude.
Himself on his own computer.
He did the cinematography too, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Written, directed, and cinematography. That's like, whew. It's a lot. It's a
yeah,
lot of
so
roles.
Like it's a fascinating film, and it does make me wonder. Like to me, it feels like that you can see how that director ends up making a film like Godzilla, and why that might not agree with why people might be disappointed in that. But Danielle, I'm curious then. Like if we sort of like just focus in on this movie, like what's your reaction to it? How did you feel about it at the time? And as you consider it, like from this vantage of distance, where are you at with it?
Absolutely. I actually only saw it for the first time the other night, this weekend, or not even this weekend. My God, it was like 2 days ago. Okay, cool. Now we're here. I saw it on Monday night. I was a bit mixed on it, to be honest. I actually loved everything with Godzilla and the Mutos, which are it's like massive. Terrestrial something organism. I don't even remember what the U is. Unidentified, I guess. Yeah, massive unidentified terrestrial organisms. I really, really, I agree in terms of the sense of scale and the sense of something alien and something wondrous and something kind of incredible with that. And I liked a lot of the character actors in this movie. I thought Bryan Cranston was a joy, a delight to behold. However, the thing that actually, there were two things that kept me from fully immersing myself. And one was, I think the main character, Ford, was really wooden. Like, really, really wooden in a way that it was like, oh, fuck. If this were just Cranston the whole way, we'd have no problems. Everything would be great. And piggybacking off of Ford, I could believe that there were massive creatures, that there were massive, you know, giant monsters. I could not believe that a military family could afford a massive apartment in San Francisco. That was like completely, utterly the one thing I couldn't believe in this movie, unless they were very independently wealthy or Elizabeth Olsen was like a specialist surgeon of some sort, which, that's one of those details that just got me. And like, I'm being funny, but like, or maybe I'm not being funny, maybe I'm trying to be funny. But it completely was just like, man, how the fuck, like for 10 solid minutes I was sitting there like, how the fuck could it possibly afford this?
I think this is a problem with movies right now is you want to use like really well-known locations, but normal people can't afford to live there anymore.
They really can't.
And so it's like, because the alternative is, and I think this is another movie that sort of looms large over Godzilla, you go the Cloverfield direction.
Sure.
Where it's a bunch of like yuppie shitheads who like, of course they can afford to live there. But they also seem like they're hard characters to empathize with in some ways because they are very much like, I don't know, what's the way to put it? They very much seem like figures like pulled straight out of like really aspirational marketing.
Completely.
But
yeah.
Yeah. And so I think you end up in a weird place where you have things like, you know, Godzilla kind of taking this tack of just a normal American family, you know, guy's home from his tour to his house in San Francisco.
He's massive.
In 2014.
Yeah, it's just, I couldn't. She could have been a surgeon. She could have been a specialist.
Maybe they got a wicked settlement, too, out of the deal. Well, but, yeah.
Yeah, it yeah. really... The real problem here for me is Ford. I don't even remember the actor's name. I don't want to throw the actor under the bus, but...
Aaron Taylor Johnson, a.k.a. the shittier Quicksilver that is gotcha. In the MCU.
All right, gotcha. That person, he just... He had a lot of work to do. To make it all kind of make sense. And I feel like everybody else was actually pretty great. Ken Watanabe was amazing. Bryan Cranston was amazing. Even Julia Binoche was incredible, like, in the small amount. But, like, this guy, so much was resting on this man's incapable shoulders to actually make the sort of emotional journey that we had to take. And I just... Mm.
He does a really unfortunate Gosling-esque... on reacting to the things he's saying, which is to say he consistently sort of underreacts and just watches. Yeah. And to a degree, I think, like, I get where that direction comes from in this film, because so much about this film is watching people react to what they are seeing, right? This is how we get the sense of scale. Yes. It is about what does it look like from the human scale when you realize these, like, massive, like, biblical scale events are happening around you. But I think in his case, a lot of it just ends up, he does, I think wooden is the exact word. There's just so many scenes where repeatedly they have him sort of up against it and possibly, like, staring his own death in the face. And there's just nothing there. It's just so hard to, like, invest yourself in the scene with him. Whereas, like, you're kind of living and dying with Cranston in all his scenes.
Oh, I rewatched that movie and I found me and my wife tearing up. He managed to sell his relationship with his wife. I mean, I'm not, you know, saying, like, I don't want to overstate the case, but, like, he managed to, like, sell, like, what was happening, like, a long unshown history with his family in the scene where he watches his wife die early in the film.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it only makes it, like, all the more frustrating in the back half of the movie to be, like, boy, like, it's for an audience surrogate character who is supposed to do the Spielberg awe shot, you know, Spielberg didn't invent the reaction shot, but he popularized, like, the notion of, like, a camera fixated on someone seeing something alien, you know, majestic in front of them in the 80s with Close Encounters and E.T. and stuff like that. And that's a lot of what is in a film like this. And Cranston's the kind of actor that can, like, sell a Richard Dreyfuss, like, can fucking sell you on that. When you're dealing with, like, such a spectacular premise, like, it's often less the plotting. You notice bad plot when, like, bad acting, bad characterization, like, takes you out of it, because then you start looking towards other things that also don't work to explain why you're not in it. And it's like, yeah, the primal scream that Cranston has as his wife is dying is, that's what you want and need throughout the rest of the film to really, like, have sold it as, like, a complete package.
Yeah.
I also love that this movie just opens. This is such a cool movie because, like, basically it does several riffs on different, like, monstrous or horror conceits, right? Like, it opens on this period piece. Like, it's very China Syndrome, the way it opens. Like, the old, like, nuclear plant control room. And you're kind of, like, you know, for me, it's disorienting watching the movie because, like, going into it the first time, I knew the movie was sort of modern day. So what are we doing back in, like, 80s Japan?
Right.
But it's... It's a cool sequence where something is going wrong in the reactor, and there's the classic, like, can his wife escape the reactor chambers beneath the plant?
And somebody, you know, falls, obviously. Of course, you know.
Yeah, and there's the whole, like, moment at the airlock, and it's really terrific. And then we get to the, there's a bit of, like, almost Chernobyl-esque, like, disaster porn that follows, where, you know, we flash forward years and he hasn't let this go, and he's convincing his son to go back into this exclusion zone to like unearth further evidence of like what really happened, because he's been sort of written off as a crank, you know, somebody who is not to be taken seriously or listened to about what happened that original incident. And I love that they're immediately pulled into this very classic setup where, you know, you've got kind of the arrogant scientists who have no idea what they're playing around with. You know, there's this idea, like, they find this monster and they're like, let's just fuck with it and see what happens. And yeah. I think, and it's so weird to me that there's, because you're right, Patrick, there were, it comes up a lot about how little you see the monsters in this movie. And I'm like, are there people seriously sitting there with a stopwatch? And unless you see, like, full frontal monster action happening, it like doesn't count, because like, yeah, no, so
this
much.
This was a huge. I mean, I'm dead serious that like that was like a big thing after this film came out, where I walked out of it and being like, "Holy shit!" Like I didn't know it was possible to bring like this sort of gravitas to this creature like that's so well known. Like I was blown away by what it did accomplish, even if it's far from a perfect film. And then immediately, like, the online discussion is like. Like 11 minutes, 42 seconds. Like, Jesus, what did I buy Christ. My ticket for? And yeah. and I think that's the result of what Godzilla became as a pop culture icon versus what Godzilla or Gojira, the original film, represents and what it was intended to be, which is like a meditation on like human disaster, human failure, and you know the results of the consequences of human action. And instead, Godzilla's like, you think the TV commercial where like Charles Barkley dunks on Godzilla and he's a big green monster that shoots, you know, atomic breath. And like, that's the popular icon of Godzilla. And I think this movie was like purposely attempting to say, like, actually, I think we've forgotten what Godzilla originally represents. Like, what if you start from there? And also, you know, because in the original Gojira, like, he doesn't. You know, the creature doesn't fight another monster, right? Like, that is introduced later to give the series something to do. And this one, you know, tries to, like, meet it halfway. And I think accomplishes that. I think part of the reason it's the stopwatch is what I was mentioning before, is, like, because, like, post-Bryan Cranston, the human stuff falls really flat, even at just a basic acting level, right? Like, it's not even like Cranston is necessarily dealing with like an incredible plotting or character arc. He just sells you on what he believes. Yeah. And you're willing to go on, you're at least willing to suspend. It's not that you believe it, but you suspend the disbelief. And it becomes tougher to suspend the disbelief when you're in the character moments later on. Then I think people started focusing on that more, on the lack of Godzilla, because it's like, all right, well, every moment we spend with this, it's like, it is a cool shot when like, you see Godzilla and the Muto fighting, and then it pans over beautifully to the characters. And the reason that frustration builds is because, well, I don't want to spend time with these characters. It was a cool-ass shot, yeah. But, like, just like go push that back to the left, even though I think the movie, and a movie like King of the Monsters, the sequel, not to get too far down that road, part of what that movie misfires is because it does, like, do a little more of the, oh, yeah, push that camera back. And it turns out, like, I think this movie's less is more. Yeah. To a really great degree.
There's an aspect of this that has to be, if I could shit a little bit on the sort of the fanboy response or the sort of like, you know, cinema sins or whatever sort of aspect of what watching nerdy movies is, and like, oh, we're here for the action. We're here for only, you know, the coolest action, the coolest special effects, that sort of thing. As opposed to like, yeah, this is a little bit more of a meditation, I think, on environmental disaster and the sort of thing. Like, if the 1954 version was a meditation on what it is to create a weapon of mass destruction and what that does to a people, like to a community of human beings, then this one is very much about, you know, oh, shit, the world's going to end in 2050 and we need to fucking do something about it. And, oh, here we have to deal with this shit right now. And
right it'll here. Just reclaim us like that, you know, exactly. You know, ultimately, like, and, you know, it's funny to have watched Game of Thrones. I'm not going to sit and spoil too much of that, but watch the conclusion of the environmentalism arc of Game of Thrones and how that just didn't go anywhere. Like, mm-hmm. It's not a spoiler to say that it was not a satisfying conclusion to like a really interesting idea for what like the ideas that that story was playing with. Like, that's what's happening here. It's like, I think that's where, you know, this is much more, like, Gojira is a horror film, and I think Godzilla is attempting to leverage elements of horror in a same way, where you are supposed to be, you don't get off your seat and cheer for Godzilla, you sit back in your seat and grip it. Like, the sequence that I think, yeah. like the scene where, the bridge scene, where Godzilla yeah. arrives in San Francisco, like, gives me goosebumps even thinking of it. Like, the specific shots, like, the way, like, the camera doesn't give you a full sense of the scale, like, because so many other monster films would deal with, like, kaiju-esque imagery. It's like, yeah, give it that big-ass wide shot, and it's like, just put in some skyscrapers. And it's like, this movie, like, it's down with the kids, and you don't really care about the kid, but, like, the camera cares about the kid, and just the way they sell, especially if you've been on that bridge in San Francisco, or just on a bridge in general, you get immediately, there are visual representations of just, like, how massive this thing is, and it just doesn't care about you. Yeah. It is just indifferent, which is what makes the human stuff so frustrating later, because it becomes so preposterous that, like, the humans and kaiju are, you know, or the titans, I guess, as this movie calls them, are bouncing off one another or, like, relying on one another. And what makes the first two-thirds of the movie so terrifying is the massive indifference, and that's how it plays into the ecological message, where it's like, actually, the humans can do whatever the fuck they want, but you know, it's coming, and the yep. best you can do is just to get out of the way.
There's this, I noticed it more this time. So in that first scene where they're trying to awaken the Muto, one of the things I really love is the Muto is, like, restrained by all these, like, steel cables, right? But the way the entire scene is shot is they keep framing, like, they keep putting frames within frames. Like, they keep, even in terms of framing, the monster is continually boxed in. So a lot of times, like, you will, like, have a rack focus shot where you lose the background and you focus in now on a security monitor that is showing the pit where the Muto is being awakened and, like, all hell is breaking loose. And so much of this movie is about, like, just moving that scale steadily up and out, where that first sequence is all just, like, kind of, we're looking at it through security monitors, we're looking at it through the eyes of, like, firemen and security guards trying to arrive to deal with the situation and realizing they can't. There's that incredible,
well, implied imagery, right? Like, yeah. It reminded me a lot of the opening scene to Jurassic Park.
Sure.
When you have the first interaction yeah. with the Velociraptor in the cage, where, like, as a kid, the payoff to when you finally see the raptors is so much more terrifying and earned because you've spent an hour in the movie wondering what the fuck that thing could do to you, because the camera never shows you what happens to that guy in the cage. Mm-hmm. But boy, like, 12-year-old Patrick had some fucked up ideas about what happened to that guy in the cage. And, like, that's a lot of, like, you know, Edwards has said he's, like, you know, deeply influenced by Spielberg. And, like, you see a lot of, in this movie, you see a lot of 70s, 80s Spielberg and how it treats the creature with a certain respect. I thought a lot of that initial raptor cage scene and just how it always is framing or setting up the later framing of the creatures.
There's a fair bit of Alien in there as well, with a lot of the suits and mm-hmm. sort of the very beginning I think it's in the Philippines, right? The sort of early cave scene. They sort of fly in and then there's that sort of cave
scene. Oh,
yeah,
when they find, like, the cave with yeah. the big skeleton and stuff like that.
They've got
yeah.
the suits, they've got the lights, they're sort of walking around in this sort of alien atmosphere. There was a whole bunch of that, and that seemed, like, really deliberate and really well done, sort of where some of those little pastiches are coming from in here.
Dale, I'm curious, though, because I also had that thought, but the other thing, I think another weakness of this movie, and you see it a lot now, is so many movies are kind of made with, like, the tacit cooperation of, like, the U.S. military.
Sure.
And so the thing is, so it's interesting to me, because the Alien, I think of Aliens, and Aliens is explicitly about how our vaunted military with its technological supremacy is kind of brain dead, yep. right? Like, that, like, technology leads to hubris, and hubris leads to catastrophic stupidity. And so you get Aliens, which is basically about, hey, let's watch, it's, you know, like Predator, it's like, hey, let's watch the cream of the military crop just get demolished, and let's also find out they're actually not that good. They're not as hard as they think they are. Yeah. They're used to winning unfair fights on the back of technology. And here,
I think there's a bit of that because everything the military does is like laughably ineffective.
Sure.
But at the same time, I don't think you get to that. It feels to me like the movie suffers a little bit from still basically being like, and the troops helped too.
Yep.
And it's to me, it feels like a weird tension because the military has to be completely ineffective and helpless, but also like good.
Yeah, part of the problem is Ford and him being everywhere all the time, being the coolest, most badass military man ever, even though it's not even his unit that he ends up hanging out with. And
he doesn't even go here.
Yeah, he doesn't even go here. What the fuck? And poor Sergeant Morales just has to be like everybody's like little like gopher all the time, and it's his actual unit. I don't know. I was a little mad about that. But anyway, like part of it is Ford, that he's like magical military man and he's the most boring guy to look at ever. And that kind of just, I mean, I suppose you could go loop all the way around after that and be like, no, really, this is a very deep commentary on how useless the military is because this cool military man is so boring and actually kind of useless and just fails upwards the whole time. But I don't think that the movie's actually doing that work to do that. And part of it is that the admiral, is he an admiral?
Strahan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually does a really good job being like stern but fair dad, which like sells that vision of like military might a little bit, where he's like, all I care about is protecting our citizens. Like he's very like, oh, this is exactly that vision of like the good military man, you know, like, oh, the good dad who cares very deeply. So it really does kind of mix things up a little bit.
And it does culminate on him basically.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
No. Like Strahan's great. Like this is like there are character actors you hire to basically, and Watanabe is another one of them, but they're character actors you hire to like, in the wrong hands, these small lines will read as absurd, right? Like, let them fight.
Oh, it's couldn't so go good, wrong. Though. Yeah, you just like, fight. That's what, that is one of a few moments where you were like, I was on my couch like, yes, let's go.
Okay, so, yeah, but I do love that Strayhorn's basic plan is basically like, well, I'm out of fucking ideas, so sure. I must protect America by just letting these monsters just trash downtown San Francisco. Yep.
Boy, would you love the sequel to this film, Rob, if you enjoyed that logic.
Good.
So, no, I'm actually really excited to see the sequel, but I gotta watch Skull Island. Anyway, but just a quick shout out, by the way. I also love the train sequence. I love how it slows the movie down, and there's sort of this long, like, journey via rail, and then it culminates in that like really eerie sequence at night. Again, this movie obscures action in really useful ways. Yeah. I think the night sequence is brilliant because you actually see very little. You get a fleeting glimpse of the monster, and the humans are literally beneath its notice. The Muto does not like even pay attention to them. They're sitting there with flashlights.
It's interested in the train and getting the.
The snack.
The new,
there's a delicious
so it can,
snack
so it can
out
eat.
There.
Yeah.
I mean, that shot where, the Muto appears, like, out of the mountain, like, and it's just one of those, like, fuck. Like, when you see a director that understands, often darkness is used to as a budgeting measure in order to just, like, just, this CG is expensive. And in here, even if that's the case, it's someone like Edwards understanding, okay, what could be a weakness can now be used as a strength if we shoot it and set it up the right way. And that way that Muto appears is just like unbelievably good.
Yeah.
I think the where the movie just like, for me, it enters the stratosphere though, is the way it does two things after the let them fight sequence, where the fight begins in San Francisco. And we get it all very human scale. It's witnessed through the eyes of bystanders, particularly through Elizabeth Olsen's character's eyes, as you're seeing the fight begin. And it's all very, handheld camera look, and you're panning and everything. You see the monsters fighting just above the like line of buildings. So it's all obscured, getting fleeting glimpses. But also that shot ends with sudden awareness that now you're back in the subway tunnel and the sort of security doors are swinging shut as everyone takes shelter.
Yeah.
And then you go from that and the movie's like, all right, done with the, normal mundane human scale of this. Now it's time for opera. And we go to the Halo jump sequence.
It's one of the most... Oh, my God, Rob. Go watch... if you don't want to watch this movie, go look up the original trailer for this film, which is essentially just the Halo jump sequence, if you want to get a sense of, like, the scene of the movie. Because I think it's one of the most, like, thrilling, scary, scale-inducing sequences I've ever seen committed to film. Like, I feel, like, pretty confident saying that.
It's just got this nightmarish, like, score going behind it, too.
Yes.
Very, like... Just, like... If you took a sample from Holst and just turned it into like a drone track is kind of how it comes across. It's just this like eerie, like building crescendoing wail as these characters are flying in this like cargo plane doing one of those high altitude drops. Does it make any sense? Probably not. I don't give a shit. Because what we get is the cargo door opens. And they're just bathed in that, like, lurid red light from sunset. And then they jump down into this, like, supercell above San Francisco. And you see them falling through the cloud cover. And it is just utterly terrifying. And it keeps going. The shot keeps going until we get his POV as he's falling through the sky on the monster fight. And so they're getting, like, they start out kind of far away. And you're looking at it from up above. And then they get bigger and bigger. And then they're above you. And you're back to the human scale. It's just such an incredible sequence. And for me, that was the point where I was like, why didn't everyone just love this film? Like, how could you not get it?
Because the highs are so high, right? Like, that's my take on it, is that I don't disagree with a lot of the criticisms of the film, but the moments that work are, like, so worth all of it that, like, yeah, that Halo sequence alone is just worth sitting for 2 hours, especially because that's after most of these films pull back the camera, you get the full scale, and it's just going to be like a third-person action video game at that point where it's like, all right, I got to watch them bash each other and it's the movie still does bits like that, but it takes the time. It is smart enough to realize you've seen them at full scale, how they're normally shown, but we're going to do one sequence that like reestablishes just how big and like terrifying and how stupid this plan is. Like it underscores how futile, like usually when the human characters have these bad ideas, you're supposed to laugh at it, and there's never any commentary how bad it is. It's just accepted that that's just how these movies go, how these stories go. And I don't want to oversell what the script is doing, but I do think the cinematography allows the movie to in some ways be commenting on like how futile all of this is. And it's like, of course you got to do something, but boy, this sure seems goofy and bad. And there at least is one line from the general where he's like, good luck on the jump, because a bunch of you are just going to hit buildings because we don't know where they are.
Yeah, completely. There was a very 2001-esque sort of sense about the music and the tone and the eeriness and the weirdness. Something that also sort of sold the horror aspect of this for me was I actually felt a sort of maybe this is somewhat unintentional, or maybe it was just that the animation struck for me, but I actually kind of felt for the creatures, like all of the creatures.
Yes.
I actually felt for the mommy Muto when her eggs were burnt. I actually was like very upset. I was, oh my God, those are her babies. Like there was a real sense of like animal behavior and logic to the way they acted that wasn't evil. They weren't creatures who like just want to fuck up your city. It's just a thing that's there. It's as if we're just in a jungle and we're a shitty tree. Like they don't care. They're just doing their thing. They mated. They had a delightful experience. And then there are these babies and like the babies got burnt. And I seriously like welled up a little bit. I was just like, oh my God. How horrifying, how, like, sad and, like, enormous and primal this sort of vibe was. And it really sort of sold the horror for me in this whole – see, I just want to call it, like, the red sequence, like, the whole red-tinted portion of the movie, for sure.
I loved that moment where – and it's the one time the humans end up kind of accidentally falling backwards into working with Godzilla because he's getting wrecked by fighting two of them at once. Right. And it is the destruction of the nest that sort of distracts them long enough for Godzilla to, go Super Saiyan. but it is like it is such an effective moment when the mom Muto like leans her head into the nest and sees they're all gone and like screams. And it is this realization, I think, without that, you don't get the point that this is a movie about nature. This is a movie about, like everyone on the planet, every being on this planet, like, wants to live, right? Like, right. That they're, like, these are also creatures in some ways like us and have similar drives. And they do feel loss. And that also sets up one of my favorite moments, which is it's kind of inversion of the sequence in the train, where this time the Muto just bypasses the Marines completely and ignores them. This time it notices and it looks at Ford. And it is it's just this great moment of, okay, you've got the god's attention now. And it's just this incredible sequence where, like, this entire movie, these monsters have been finding completely oblivious to the humans around them. And after that nest is destroyed, suddenly the Muto is very much like, yeah, Godzilla, I'll deal with him later. Where'd that little fucker go?
Yep. This annoying bug just killed my babies.
This vicious little bug.
Yeah.
I gotta kill it. Yeah, and then Godzilla comes in, and he's about to get, like, you know, killed by the Muto, and just the way that the sudden, like, the wash of, like, white light that you have no idea what is happening, and then you see, like, the electro tail appearing out of the mist, it's incredible.
Yeah. And I will say, like, a lot of what sells all this stuff, and we haven't really touched on it too much at this point, I just want to make sure and underscore it, is, like, part of what makes the cinematography work is also, like, the exceptional sound design. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie has, I'm not a big audiophile, but, like, this movie, like, so benefits from an extraordinary sound system being listened to loud and being, it's a sound design that demands to be paid attention to, because most of that stuff is so incidental in a lot of blockbuster films. But in this movie, like, the sound is such a character. It is used with great emphasis to sell the empathy you can build for the empathy that all the emotions that you run with the creatures, whether it's being terrified or whether it's empathy, like the scream that Muto has, like, you buy it, and it's also terrifying because, like, in there is, like, something primal, you feel bad for it, but also, like, that thing is gonna fuck me up if I don't get out of the way. And, you know, I love Godzilla's roar in this movie. It feels very primal and beastly in a way that the scream from Gojira and the other Toho films is maybe was scary at the time, and with, like, as by virtue of pop culture icon, it becomes flattened in a way that is not the sound's fault, but the way it reestablishes, like, a growl, like, just go look up Godzilla's roar on YouTube and just, like feel, like, the bass as, like, it's just so finely tuned in a way that that was another part of the movie that I appreciated so much more on the second viewing, because a lot of Danielle's totally rightful criticisms of, like, the things you get hung up on, like, where they live in San Francisco and how can they afford that. It's like once you understand the movie's, like, strengths and its goals and, like, what it's really aiming for, and you can hone in and better appreciate that stuff, that's when, like, it went from, like, a movie I liked a lot when I saw it to just, like, a masterclass on second viewing, was noticing things like the sound design where it's just like, oh, something that's usually an afterthought or is just, like, a checkbox. Not that those people don't work hard on things that you checkbox in a $300 million movie, but in this movie, it's such a high priority, and I think it pays off spectacularly.
Yeah, it's a movie that I think is useful to... Is it useful, like, point of comparison to the way a lot of, like, CG-heavy action movies end up looking, where there's a lot of, like, sound and fury, and there's a lot of, like, moving imagery, but it doesn't really, like, nothing registers, nothing, like, so little stands out, right? This is the criticism of a lot of, like, Marvel, you know, culminating action sequences. They are just CGI bonanzas, but it's all curiously weightless and just kind of washes off of you.
But those movies have, feel free to disagree, plenty of people do, those movies are live and die by the characters,
yes,
right? And so it's like the action sequences are almost perfunctory they are in some ways exposition for or just a means to an end, which is to get to character moments. You know, a movie like Endgame has fighting, but what I cried over was like not the, you know, the blasts out of Iron Man's arm cannon.
Yeah.
And so like this movie is an inversion of that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But it does end up being this real showpiece of like how all these other crafts can really like amplify the effect and meaning of a movie. So yeah, I mean, like for me, this is like, I absolutely love this movie. I loved it the first time. I loved revisiting it. I hope Gareth Edwards gets let out of movie jail.
It sounds actually more like,
oh no,
it's reading between the lines. It sounds like more he was like traumatized by the experience of making Star Wars, and so less movie jail and more like he was supposed to do the sequel to Godzilla. Like he had signed up where he was, because like it's been, you know, 5 years. That's a long ass time in between like sequels to like popular franchise movies. And he had, Godzilla was such, it was a modest hit, but like it was such a visual spectacle that like as they were staffing up Star Wars, he became like an easy pickup. And so he signed on for Rogue One, and the thought was like, all right, he was supposed to do the Godzilla sequel, but like he'll go do Star Wars, he'll come back. And after Star Wars, when the Tony Gilroy stuff, when that movie kind of went a little off the rails towards the end of production, he like pulled himself back and was just like, I cannot do another spectacle movie. I'm not going to do the next Godzilla. And so I think it's more that dude like took his money and was like, I need to go recharge. But it's such a bummer because especially King of the Monsters, the new Godzilla film. And I like Michael Dougherty, the director, writer. He did a movie called Trick or Treat, which I think is a great, one of the great horror anthology films. His follow-up to that, Krampus, which is just such a fun, delightful horror B-movie with a great interpretation of Krampus. He struggles in the sequel to... The King of the Monsters turns into more of a Toho sequel classic in which, like, the story makes no sense and character motivations have no meaning, and it's goofy, and it's not quite a celebration of that because it's also cribbing the aesthetic of the original film, which is like treating these as like nightmarish creatures to be respected. And the movie is instead like, well, but what if we had that, but also like they were toys and we hit them, which is fine. Like I love those Godzilla movies too. I weep for the non-existent Gareth Edwards sequel and hope he comes back to making films again, because you just watch a movie like that and go, oh, you can't just replace that level of eye. And he's just someone that, to blockbuster filmmaking, is just able to put you there in a way that a lot of other filmmakers really just don't understand how to do.
Yeah. For me, I think this movie sort of underscores why I hope he can get more shots at making movies like this. Cause I think he has an incredible eye for telling these stories. I'm bummed to hear that King of the Monsters doesn't quite stack up.
It's like a movie you should just go into with like radically shifted expectations. Yeah. Like because the trailers, I only watched the first one because I was like, all right, this movie is a spectacle film. I don't need to watch more than the first trailer, otherwise I'm just having shots spoiled for me. And the first trailer for King of the Monsters is spectacular. It's almost as good as like the original Godzilla trailers in. Has his beautiful music. All the shots are like the best shots in the movie, where it treats the creatures as majestic and interesting and wondrous. And the movie itself is just in a way where like the things that are frustrating in this film that don't work are just all the way at the front. And the monster fighting, while occasionally spectacular, is largely, it feels like you're watching like you see the CG in a way that Edwards' Godzilla, intellectually it's computer generated, but it helps you suspend the disbelief in a way that like it's okay. And that it wouldn't, if you put people in suits, it wouldn't be nearly as spectacular. Although I do want to see, everyone keeps telling me, and maybe we could revisit it sometime, is Shin Godzilla.
Shin Godzilla. Yeah. I was actually going to bring that up. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's the last Toho-produced basically when this Godzilla universe started, they basically entered into an agreement where they wouldn't make Godzilla films till like this sort of like finished out. And the last one they made in between Godzilla and Godzilla King of the Monsters was the director of Evangelion, whose name escapes me. Rob, do you know?
Oh, God, no.
Okay. All right. Sorry,
let's
Austin.
Let's take a look.
Kato? Kato?
Itatakiano.
No one? There you go. I don't know what he said.
I don't know what he said either.
But he's Kato said it, even if the mic didn't pick it up.
Yeah,
anyway, so he directed
Hideaki?
Hideaki
Anno.
Okay, yes. You know, well known as the director of Evangelion, did Shin Godzilla, a movie that is like supposed to be about the bureaucratic nightmare, yes, response to the tsunami, and is really like a movie about bureaucracy and the failures of government, and apparently has some really grotesque,
yes,
disgusting takes on Godzilla, going from like a small baby to like fully formed thing, and also, yeah, embraces the man in suit roots.
Yeah.
And like has a man in suit aided by CG. And I don't know why I haven't seen it yet.
It's
but
fascinating.
I've heard
it's seen it?
I know. So for a long time, it didn't come out. I missed it in theaters.
Right.
And then it got delayed coming out on digital due to like weird rights stuff for like 18 months. And so then it just like left my consciousness. Because I didn't want to pirate it because I didn't want like a 1080p version. Like I wanted to watch like a nice Blu-ray of it. So I finally bought it. And
Blu-ray is 1080p.
I will say the...
Right, but like there's a difference between streaming 1080p and getting that off a disc, Rob.
Okay, but if it's a downloaded file, it's not a stream. It's Danielle, did you see the movie?
So what happened was my friend that we do movie nights, we watched Godzilla 2014, and she was like, I just watched Shin Godzilla over the weekend. So she was excited to watch Godzilla 2014. And then after we watched the movie that we just talked about for an hour, she then spooled up for me a bunch of YouTube videos of the transformations, of the creature design itself. Some really grotesque, really fascinating stuff that made the Godzilla from the 2014 movie look kind of cute in comparison. Like, it's a cute dog. It's like a cute, like, German Shepherd kind of thing on a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Versus this, like, Kato, you'll know. What is the fucked up... Not the goldfish-looking thing, but the, like, useless Pokemon that's, like, shitty. And then it turns into, like, an
awesome... Are we talking about Sobble?
Gyarados. It turns into Gyarados.
Wow!
No, not Sobble!
Rob.
Magikarp.
It looks like a fucked up Magikarp that turns into a Gyarados.
Yeah.
But it's, like, in mid-transition, and it does, like, a... Oh, my God. It sort of rears up on its back as it's transforming, so it looks like a fucked up fish thing. Rears up on its back and, like... wiggles its shitty, stubby, like, going to be Tyrannosaurus Rex arms, but they're just, like, shitty stubs. Oh, it's amazing. The animation is incredible. It's much lower budget. Much, much, much lower budget. But going for a completely different, like, almost zombie movie aesthetic in terms of the shots. Not zombies, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
yeah,
colorful and a little sick and a little gross and a little, like, grainy, that sort of thing, versus this, like, beautiful, majestic palette of the 2014 movie that we were just talking about. Fascinating visually. I got very excited there, but really, really interesting visually.
I need to check out Skull Island and Shin Godzilla then to sort of...
Skull Island is good because, relative to King of the Monsters, it's a movie that... So Skull Island goes for like a Vietnam,
yeah,
like aesthetic and is goofy as shit. And like funnier, John Goodman's in it, and I'll watch anything with him in it.
Sure.
It's whereas like King of the Monsters doesn't know what tone it's going for. Like this movie, while not like spectacular, like knows what it wants to do and embraces its like B movie qualities in a way that like let's go. Like I was on board for. So even though it exists in the same world, and I'm curious how they collide those in the movie next year, which is coming from Adam Wingard, who did that shitty Death Note movie on Netflix and hasn't done a good movie since Your Next. So I'm not terribly confident about it, but I'd be curious what you thought of it, Rob. So we should at least,
yeah,
shout those out in the future as we work our way through them.
Speaking of embracing B-movie characteristics, I got one more thing I want to talk to you about, but we will hit that after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so while I was on vacation, there were at times a lack of things to do. And one of my friends that I was hanging out with on vacation introduced me to the YouTube channel for the food magazine, Bon Appetit.
Yes.
And which seemed like a weird thing to, like, hey, let's hang on vacation and watch a bunch of Bon Appetit videos. And yet, the way this was pitched to me was, oh, it's like Culinary Giant Bomb. And I was like, okay, you got my interest. And I think I can sort of see where that's coming from. There's also a bit of like old school one up. But basically, like, I ended up watching a shit ton of these videos that are largely shot out of the test kitchen they have for the magazine at what looks like One World Trade Center. But they've got this tremendous, like, giant test kitchen where everyone is in there working on recipes and experimenting with stuff for the magazine. And they just started shooting videos out of that, sort of trying to showcase the special interests of the various editors and testers who are there. And I think one of the things that was immediately useful to me was there is this series called It's Alive, starring Brad Leone. I was talking about this on Twitter the other day. And I think this is maybe where the Giant Bomb comparisons are most immediate. Brad Leone comes a bit across as like cooking Dan Reichert in some ways. It is like at once like enormously knowledgeable, but also has like surprising gaps in that knowledge that like are kind of fascinating to encounter. And a lot of the humor is watching other members of the Bon Appetit team sort of bounce off this character and watching him bounce off of them. But he did the series. In general, his series are about like fermentation and like live cultures and such in food. But he did the series where he went camping. And it's an interesting thing because it's just him in these videos, but the cameraman is a character, this guy named Vinny. And a lot of these videos is him just talking at his cameraman and just having conversations as he just like narrates to Vinny, not to the audience, to Vinny, what is happening. But you end up like doing the showcase on campfire cooking, which ended up being immediately useful because I did a fair bit of that myself. And inhaled way too much smoke, and still felt pretty rough by the end of that vacation, but also kind of triumphant. But they're weird, goofy videos. But I think the stuff that I really love from them was this woman, Claire Saffitz, does this series, Gourmet Makes, and this is more my shit. It is like reverse engineering popular junk food to figure out how you could make it at home. And so like she started out by like, how the fuck do you make a Twinkie? Like if you were like, because you can't just make cake and then put cream on it because like it won't have the structure. It just wouldn't work. So like the Twinkie is this weird thing that we've all encountered, but how is it actually made? How does it work? How do you make a thing that retains those characteristics and that texture that is also like stable enough to eat? Without resorting to, because what you don't have is recourse to all the like advanced sort of food materials science that major snack companies have. And so a lot of Gourmet Makes is about like getting at the essence of junk food and why it works and why people like it. But then also, how do you translate that into real food? That you can make at home with like ingredients that are familiar. And the one video, like, I shared it with you. I don't know if you had a chance to watch, but there was this video where she tries to figure out, like, how the fuck do you make a Dorito? Oh, and
yeah.
It seems simple because I always just assume, like, okay, it's a type of nacho chip they just spray down with seasoning. But if you think about it, it's not like a nacho chip at all. And so there's this, like, it's a long video of, like, her journey into madness trying to figure out, like, you're there in your kitchen. You got all the ingredients you could ask for. You can't make a Dorito to save your life.
Because it's spongier. It's almost like a seashell in some ways with like pockets of.
That's the thing. It's the pockets.
Wow. I'm just thinking about this now and my mind is going to galaxy brain on this. This is wild.
Well, and that's the appeal. It's every video is. And the cool thing is. It's partly like just watching her sort of scientific method and experimentation as she goes through it. But also it's cool to see like how she does like almost consults with the rest of the staff. So there's this one dude, Chris Morocco, who is apparently like the super taster of the team, who just has this uncanny ability to break down just from a single bite of food, like what all is happening in it from a texture standpoint, from a flavor standpoint. And then from that, extrapolate, like, well, here's how that was probably accomplished. And so as she's trying to work on this, she's also bringing in more and more people to try to figure out, like, what is a Dorito? It starts becoming this really, like, weirdly existential question of, like, what is Dorito? We've all encountered it a million times, but, like, if you start thinking about it, it makes less and less sense. Like, you've zoomed in to the point where, like, the Dorito is lost, and now you are just, like, obsessed with, like, how do you make a corn chip with that many, like, tiny little micro pockets?
Yeah. Oh, my God. My mind is seriously, like, blowing right now. This is incredible.
It's that every video. And so that ended up being a really fun way to spend a good portion of my break is watching these videos. And I wouldn't have expected from Bon Appetit because I always consider that kind of a you know, it's a Condé Nast publication. It's a really, I think it's sort of more old school than, say, like Serious Eats is, or that was always my impression. It's a little glossier. And so it is so funny to see this YouTube series that really does feel like, what if you were just like hanging out in the kitchen with all your friends who are like master chefs and like food scientists?
Oh, so fascinating to me. I know I will dive into this and not be able to stop myself. I've recently watched like 6 seasons straight of The Great British Bake Off. As somebody who doesn't eat a lot of baked goods or bake or anything else, I didn't know where this interest would come from. But there's something about food, the aesthetics and the construction of food that tickles something in some part of my brain, and I cannot quite put my finger on it, but I am utterly fascinated by this stuff.
I think there's an element of a lot of like scientific investigation is completely beyond what our experience is. Like you can tell me about like the exciting findings of like a you know, human physiology study or like a you know, long-term biological study based on like samples of different populations. Like all that stuff, the findings can be interesting, but I can't translate. It doesn't have immediate meaning to me. I'm not familiar enough with the core concepts. I can't go on that journey with the authors, for instance. It's just there's too much specialized knowledge. Cooking is just familiar enough where like with my knowledge base, I get what they're driving at roughly and I can follow along, but they're still operating at this much higher level. And so it's this really interesting thing of you get sort of the pleasure of like scientific investigation, but without the necessity for a decade of school.
Sure.
And I think that's probably what ends up speaking to me a lot, particularly with the Gourmet Make stuff, which is just very much about like you take something familiar that you've seen a million times, and you ask for the first time, like, what is this?
Yes. It's like the glitter thing we talked about, almost.
Yeah.
Like, this really hyper-familiar thing that is everywhere, but looking at it from that lens, it's like, holy shit, what really is this at a molecular level? Or not molecular, but you know what I mean? Like, a very intense investigation. Oh, it's so awesome.
Also, it's just cool, because it reminds you, like, everything you can accomplish with, like,
a good camera operator and editor, and like a single like big open space that's meant for the thing you're using it for. Just watching that is like really kind of instructive about like in some ways there's a lot of upfront cost doing something like that. But on the other hand, there's something so simple about it that's just, you know, the skill of the people and, you know, the videographer, the editors and the crew and the talent that really is impressive, that it feels so informal and yet so polished. So I found it fascinating. I highly endorse it. If you are like looking for something maybe a little more serious than like Nailed It, and you've sort of exhausted the Great British baking show, then I highly recommend like, hey, look up the Bon Appetit videos and just go back. There's clearly a change in the video. I think the start of It's Alive is when their YouTube strategy changed. Before that, it's very familiar, like a magazine YouTube page.
Sure.
But like with It's Alive and then after, they started leaning more and more into like personality-led stuff. And it's really good. And I like it a lot. So
I can't wait.
Give it a shot. Everyone should watch it. This is probably ends with me trying to make Twinkies. Just because.
You do that at E3, please?
Yes.
Can you try and make a Twinkies at E3?
I couldn't.
It's just like cell phone video. Just film that.
Watch the video. Amazing. No, I can't. It is so much more. Like, you're like, could you? Yeah, Rob, could you do that at E3? And it's like, yes, that is all I could do at E3. Like, I would spend like half that week being like, sorry, Patrick, you can go to these three appointments because I don't know, man. This dough is not holding together, not baking up right.
Rob's Twinkie 3.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, nice.
Did we do it? Did we get there? Is that an episode title?
Yeah, well, we sort of got there, but I think Twinkie 3 could be something
else. No, on the way it could there, go wrong. Danielle. I get it.
Yeah.
I understand.
All right, so... I think that is where we will leave it. Our thanks to...
Wait, Danielle has her mini shout-out.
It's a pre-shout-out.
I thought she was holding it.
Yeah, just to get people ready for it.
All right.
One day, at some point, potentially, we will maybe talk about Tuca and Birdie, an amazing, wonderful animated series by Lisa Hannawalt starring Tiffany Haddish? Is it just Haddish or Haddish? Good question.
I think it's Haddish.
Haddish. Tiffany sure. Haddish and Ali Wong as 30-something bird women. It's very BoJack in style, but very, very, very like centered on women's experiences and very much New York versus L.A., which... All of these things are beautiful. The characters are amazing. And we will talk about it maybe one day. It is a pre-shout-out.
Is it as crushingly bleak as BoJack?
No. Actually, no.
Okay, great.
I actually found a lot of hope in it. And it's much more about, not to spoil anything, but there's much more about encountering difficult things and trying to heal from them and trying to sort of find healthier ways of dealing with shit than BoJack necessarily does.
Cool. We'll have to check that out and look forward to circling back on it after E3.
Yeah.
That will do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. It'll get you there. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people keep up with you online?
At Patrick Lubick.
Danielle.
At Danielle RI. And if you feel like it, go on Instagram and go to Vice Reports.
And you can find our producer at twitter.com/a_Kado_appears. That'll do it for Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Please be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. I like to think we're a 5-star podcast, but it's not for me to say. Power's in your hands. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio. Well, do we have a Friday
soon?
Show?
No, you're going to get 5 podcasts next week.
No, so. I think we do, because we're going to record something tomorrow, right?
Are we? Picado?
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a look, probably.
We'll probably be back again with Waypoint Radio on Friday. just really, really spiked that outro.
There's a thing.
Do not give in to astonishment.
Though I guess that's really the opposite meaning from Godzilla 2014.
Yeah.
Which is that
yeah, it's like actually
you should be astonished.
Give all the way in. Exactly. Give in.
clap.
What the fuck?
Excuse me, Rob?
What happened?
Oh, just new browser stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was trying to open the Waypoints doc, and every time I opened it, instead of opening it, I think because it was loading all that for the first time in Firefox, every time I tried to like double-click on the Waypoints doc, just so I could read the boilerplate, instead it was like I had a random spin, and the browser scrolled down to just like deep into my drive folder.
Oh.
It was weird and disorienting. All right. shall we go on 30?
Sure.
Yeah, I guess. Just sit here and wait a long time for that number to tick up.
Did you miss it?
No. Absolutely
no, you
not.
Guys were actually just in sync.
Yeah, it was in sync, brother. You were
okay.
I'm sorry that in that 10 seconds you fell asleep and then weren't paying attention, but, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Good.
Oh, shit, that's right. I've got to opt out of this shit. Sorry. I just got an email from Chase that's like, you want to agree to binding arbitration, right? And I was like, I sure don't. All right, sorry. It, like...
Oh, I got that too this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't read it. I saw a bunch of bold text that said important. I was like, usually I would just archive that and just not even pay attention. It's just
this
whatever.
Was going around Twitter in the fine, like in the super fine print. Basically, they're like, "Hey, are you cool with foregoing?
You must mail your rejection to us." Oh, good, thanks, but yeah. I will. Don't you worry.
Yeah,
just gotta buy
fuck
a stamp.
All right. You know, I have not used the tilt feature on this monitor nearly enough. I feel like a king. I'm, like, looking down into the monitor right now, and, like, oh, man, this view angle is just pristine. All right, anyway. Here we go.
Uh-huh.
Haven't done this for a week. Oh, boy. Woo!
Wow!
Nailed. No, okay. All right, Rob, you can go at 45.
Nailed it!
Oh no! All right, think something sad. Deadly Class got canceled. That was bullshit.
Oh.
All right.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.